This episode of Bright Hearth is brought to you by Indigo Sundry Soap Company, Rooted Pines Homestead, Joe Garrisey with Backwards Planning Financial, and by our supporters at patreon.com. The task of a father in his home can be described in many ways. If you've listened to my preaching and teaching over the years, you've likely heard me describe godly masculinity using William Mauser's five aspects, that godly men are lords, husbandmen, saviors, sages, and glory bearers. Each of these vocations is helpful in understanding a man's role. Another way we might think about this task can be seen in comparison of the task given to our first father, Adam, and how it echoes later in the work of the priests in the temple. Both Adam and the priests are told to work and keep their gardens. Adam's garden was the first garden, a garden in Eden. God commanded him to take dominion there, to be fruitful there, to work and to keep the garden, that is, to cultivate it into its full potential of flowering and joy, and then to guard it, to defend it from enemies, work and keep. Likewise, the priests were set in a garden, for that is what the tabernacle, and later the temple, was. The tabernacle was a mobile diorama of the garden in Eden, complete with a tree of life in the form of the golden lampstand, cherubim guarding the holy place, and garden imagery all throughout. Like Eden, the entrance opened to the east. Like Eden, which was full of precious stones, the priest wore vestments bedecked with precious stones. Many other parallels can be seen between the garden and the tabernacle and then the temple. The priests, like Adam, were told to do the same as him, to work and to keep the temple garden. They were to cultivate the glory of a people at peace with God through their work, overseeing worship and sacrifice, all ultimately pointing to the work of Christ, the true priest. They were also told to keep the tabernacle and temple, to defend and guard it from anything unclean, from anything defiling. In this season of Bright Hearth, we're talking about cultivating households that cultivate, defend, and radiate truth, goodness, and beauty. In today's episode, we'll see how the work of the father, of the patriarch of the home, is essential to this task. Patriarchs are guardians of truth, goodness, and beauty in the household. The father's godly headship is essential to making the home a place where truth, goodness, and beauty are cultivated, defended, and radiated out to the world. They are to work and keep the home to this end, to cultivate the household and those in it like a garden, bringing it to full flowering, and then to keep and defend that which is found there from the defiling of evil, lies, and ugliness. In all of this, we know that a godly patriarchy can only be so by grace and through faith in the second Adam, the Lord Jesus Christ, remembering our passage for this season, 2 Peter 1:3-11. His divine power has granted to us all things that pertain to life and godliness, through the knowledge of him who called us to his own glory and excellence, by which he has granted to us his precious and very great promises, so that through them you may become partakers of the divine nature, having escaped from the corruption that is in the world because of sinful desire. For this very reason, make every effort to supplement your faith with virtue, and virtue with knowledge, and knowledge with self-control, and self-control with steadfastness, and steadfastness with godliness, and godliness with brotherly affection, and brotherly affection with love. For if these qualities are yours and are increasing, they keep you from being ineffective or unfruitful in the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. For whoever lacks these qualities is so nearsighted that he is blind, having forgotten that he was cleansed from his former sins. Therefore, brothers, be all the more diligent to confirm your calling and election, for if you practice these qualities, you will never fall. For in this way, there will be richly provided for you an entrance into the eternal kingdom of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ.
Welcome back to Bright Hearth, everybody. Brian and Lexi are here for another episode in our season on truth, goodness, and beauty. Brian, what are we talking about today?
Well, you know, we're talking about fathers being defenders and guardians of truth, goodness, and beauty. We're playing a little footsie, it seems like.
It's a bouncy chair. I can't help it.
Right now our kids are napping in our current recording room, our bedroom. So we're in the girls' bedroom. Yep. Surrounded by butterflies.
Cute oil paintings of flowers.
Flowers and kitchen sets. So, man, it's good to be here with you, babe.
It's been a while. What are we talking about?
Indeed. Well, we're talking about husbands. But before we do that, a few housekeeping notes, because we do still have time. As this episode comes out, I think we're about 60 days out from our conference here in June, June 6th to the 8th, New Christendom Conference. And we're doing, this one's called Building Christian Boroughs, where we're looking at King Alfred and the work that he did in England in being the only king in England called the Great, worthy of the name, the Great. And we're using him as a model for how to build local communities that have these kinds of Christian cultural thickness to defend and to build that which is worth building and defending. We have a discount code for the conference in the description, so make sure you check it out. We'd love to have you all join us there. We still have some slots open for ladies for the singles mixer. I think we have like maybe 8 or 9 slots total left.
Oh, that's cool.
For the ladies singles mixer. So it's $1, ladies, to add on the singles
mixer.
But
no men,
mixer.
No more men allowed.
The men are full.
Okay.
Men are full. But they're close. Like they're only about 8 or 9 away from being the same number. So we're hoping that we'll get them 1-to-1 by the time the conference gets there. And I also just wanted to continue to shout out Indigo Sundries, because you guys have, we had them on, Garrett and Sophia Collier, a few episodes back. And since then, those guys are closer than ever to being able to go full time with their soap making.
That's cool.
Business endeavor. So keep supporting them. If you haven't already, get like a 6 or a 10 bar deal from them. There's, again, there's a link in the description and a discount code.
That's cool that they do it like that.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. So you can get, that's the best deal, I think, is the 10 bar.
Probably.
Deal. I love everything I've tried from them. We are also their test kitchen a little bit. So they send us like their tallow soap they're working on and things like that. But check them out. And lastly, if you love the show, support us on Patreon and you'll get access to our special patrons only show in the kitchen, where Lexi's going through Roger Scruton's book on beauty. If she can find it.
I'm a few chapters in, like 5 chapters in, and I can't find the book. So we're going to probably pause, or we could just keep doing other stuff. Anyways,
yeah, we do other stuff in the
meantime. I'm going to finish it, but. Yeah.
So some practical stuff, and that's most weeks we're able to put out it in the kitchen. That's helpful. We're actually going to record one today with both of us talking about the nasty spirit of legalism that suffuses everything we do and this show in particular. So
we keep getting accusations of, only not specific enough, unfortunately.
It's never specific enough to repent if we need to.
It's like a vague spirit of something.
It's a nasty spirit of
nasty
legalism.
Nasty spirit. So me specifically.
I hope you guys can tell we're joking. We don't think that we radiate a nasty spirit of legalism, but we're going to talk about that in the kitchen, and that will be released the same day this episode comes out there on Patreon for supporters. But let's get right to it here. We're talking about, last time we talked about mothers, and we talked about the homemaker, the lady of the hearth, and how her spirit is one of those foundation stones in beauty in the home. Lest we run away this season and start talking about decorating and kitchens and all sorts of other beautiful things and don't actually address the inside of the cup before you get the outside. So we talked a lot about this one and we figured it would make sense for us to talk about some of the corresponding ways in which fathers are foundational, the man of the house, in serving as a guardian not just a guardian, but also cultivating and defending truth, goodness, and beauty. And so first, I just wanted to make sure that from the cold open that we got our terms defined right, because we're going to be using this paradigm of working and keeping to talk about these different aspects of a father's role in the home. So when I say working, what I mean is cultivation. When I say that a father is to work in the home, the garden of the home, I mean that he is to cultivate an atmosphere of truth in the home and to cultivate an atmosphere of goodness and of beauty in the home, that he's actually tending, planting, pruning, all of these things. And then when I say keep, I'm talking about defending, that there are actually enemies, both inward enemies, internal enemies from within your own soul and within your own household, that are going to be enemies of truth and goodness and beauty, and also external enemies that would seek to come in and sneak into the home, sometimes subversively and sometimes overtly. Just note, we want to destroy your home, that a father needs to protect his home from. And again, these come from the garden and the priesthood. God uses the same exact words when he's commanding Adam, and then later when he's commanding the priest through Moses, that their duty is to work and keep the garden, and then later the temple, which, like I kind of briefly noted in the cold open, the temple is basically a mini garden. It's supposed to be an image of God's fellowship with man, and that man, and that the promise that God made in the garden, that the seed of the woman would come and crush the head of the serpent, isn't finished.
Are you tired of all the plastic toys that are cheaply made in China?
How about the greenwashing that comes with wooden toys covered in harmful chemicals, yet claiming they're safe for littles because the FDA said so? Well, look no further. At Rooted Pines Homestead, husband and wife, along with their five young children, work together as a family economy to create handmade, natural wooden toys and goods that can be passed down to future generations in small batch organic and wildcrafted herbal remedies. From using locally sourced wood to coloring toys with real foods and plants, they deliver various types of wooden products that are coated with only two ingredients, local beeswax and organic expeller-pressed coconut oil. Talk about food safe. Their family values include being good stewards, making sure that their products are the highest quality and not harmful to families, homes, or our environment. They also teach free herbalism on their YouTube channel for those wanting to take back what New Agers have tried to distort in worshiping creation rather than the Creator. Why support the big companies who knowingly use cheap, toxic ingredients because it's better on their pocket when you can get 10% off your order using code BRIGHTHEARTH10, that's all caps, BRIGHTHEARTH10, to support your brothers and sisters in Christ at Rooted Pines Homestead? Check out the show notes for more details and connect with them on social media. If you have a young family like me, you work hard every day to ensure you care for your wife and kids. Providing for a young family is challenging, with rising costs, and it doesn't look like things are going to change in the future. Maybe you've thought, like I have, I wish I'd started investing years ago. My family would be in a better financial position. As they say about trees, the best time to plant a tree was 10 years ago. The second best time is today. Don't let the benefit of time go to waste on your financial planning for retirement or inheritance for your generations. Joe Garrisey with Backwards Planning Financial has been working with us to make the best plan for our family. He's a Christian who works with one of the largest and most trusted financial service companies in the world. He's been helping Lexi and I work towards our financial goals and helps us navigate the complexities of the markets. Whether you have millions in assets or you're just starting to invest, Joe Garrisey can help you reach your goals to grow the kingdom and leave a good legacy for your generations. Visit BackwardsPlanningFinancial.com, that's BackwardsPlanningFinancial.com, or call 615-767-2555 to speak with Joe to prepare for the future. The testimonials presented may not be representative of the experience of other clients and are not a guarantee of future performance or success. So working and keeping. Am I missing anything? Does that all make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Can people follow? Okay, excellent. So let's talk about truth in the home. The father working and keeping the home to be a home and a household where truth is cultivated, defended, and radiated. So what are some ways that a father can work truth into the culture of the home? What comes to mind for you thinking about, you have a husband, you have a man.
I do.
what are some ways that you think it's important that a husband can cultivate truth in the home?
I think the two things that come to mind immediately are education and family worship.
Yeah.
I think sometimes husbands might want to just entirely pass off education to the mother, but I think he definitely needs to have his hands involved in there too. But yeah, family worship and just, I guess, just taking an active role in all of that instead of a passive role. So
yeah, that's really important. When you think about the education of children, which we've talked about on this podcast before, and you look at the commands in scripture, they're given to the father.
Yeah.
In Deuteronomy 6, and in Ephesians 6.
It's not like
Ephesians
the father,
6.
Unless the mom is really into Charlotte Mason, and then it's all to the mother.
Yeah, that's right.
That's what I mean. Like, don't, ladies, don't be that way.
Yeah. So a father cultivates an atmosphere of truth in his home, partly by ensuring that he's fulfilling the duties to his children of educating them Christianly.
Yes.
Meaning he's giving whatever, that's the principle, Christian education, however you work it out in homeschooling, Charlotte Mason, classical trivium, whatever you do, private school, you're giving them a Christian education so that your children are learning how to discern truth from error.
Yeah.
They're learning how to, not just in spiritual quote unquote things, but also in earthly things, in political things, in historical things, in art and music, and like all these different aspects of life. A father has a direct responsibility. And I would add that you're not saying this either, that doesn't mean that he directly teaches every subject.
Correct. Yeah.
On the curriculum. You know, obviously we have a private school through our church, St. Brennan's Classical Christian Academy, which, by the way, just for the record, New Christendom Press just launched a new podcast called St. Brennan's Podcast with our headmaster, Headmaster Love, that is all things education. So just go search that wherever you get podcasts, St. Brennan's Podcast, and you'll find it. I forgot completely about that, but go check it out. And, but that doesn't mean, obviously, I have oversight in my home over making sure that my children are raised in the discipline and understanding of the Lord. And then I'm employing deputies. So when Lexi homeschooled in our home, it meant that I needed to have an idea of what was going on. Mm-hmm. I didn't just say, good luck. No, we talked about it. I was involved. I'm making sure she has resources she needs.
There were even times when you called curriculum shots that I didn't agree with, that I was still like, okay. This is what we're doing.
Yep. Even so, starting a school.
What do you mean?
Even starting a school ultimately was one of the things that you didn't nag me into starting. You weren't like, we need to start a school. Read books and you pointed me to books and I read books. And then both of us came to convictions about starting a school.
Yeah, we vacillated all over the place over the years.
Yeah, we did.
In terms of schooling stuff. Yeah.
But all of it, the father's a guardian. He's cultivating and making sure that his children aren't just being sent to the government for education in transgenderism and creative sexual sin and folly and evolutionary biology and all these stupid ideas. Instead, the father's saying, no, the kid's education is my responsibility. Mm-hmm. I'm going to cultivate it through the active participation of my leadership in educational decisions, even in including who I'm choosing as deputies, if it's authorizing, saying, you know, honey, we're going to homeschool. Here's what I need from you. You're going to have to do some reading. It's going to be hard work for you, but I'm going to be there backing you up, helping you, directing, or this is the school they're going to go to. These are the teachers they're going to have. The husband really needs to be not just kind of passively drifting and saying, good luck, honey, in making sure the kids aren't ignoramuses and ungodly. What about on the other side? That's children.
Okay.
How is a husband, how can he help to cultivate and be a guardian of truth when it comes to his wife's mind and intellectual and spiritual life, the things she's reading, the thoughts she's thinking? How can I, for example, be a help to you in cultivating and defending you from lies?
I think actually talking to me and not just like, hey, let's just watch Netflix again, or like the roommate type model of we each have our chores, we get our stuff done, and then we go our separate ways after everyone's in bed.
Yeah.
Like actually spending time together to actually talk, because there's no other way to know what she's thinking or reading or learning or hearing or sad about or happy about unless you're actually talking to her. Mm-hmm. So you don't actually know where to defend her if you're not doing that.
Yeah. It's never been easier for a housewife, a stay-at-home mom to access vast amounts of theological, cultural, political, historical, educational material and entertainment material in the form of podcasts and audiobooks and YouTube videos. You can like literally attend postgraduate level college courses for free via the internet now.
Yeah.
Right. So a mom can be doing the laundry and listening to lectures in Aquinas. Mm-hmm. Or she can be, you know, pulling weeds in the garden and watching the kids ride bicycles and listening to, an audiobook on covenant theology.
Yeah.
So that's a great gift, a great blessing. Mm-hmm. I think we'll talk about more this season, the intellectual life of the housewife. Mm-hmm. But there's also, I think, a hidden reef there that you can run aground on as a husband. And it's failing to actually lead your wife to be involved in her intellectual life, to shepherd and make sure that, wait, is my wife having her heart and her mind won by something that I'm unprepared for, or by something that I don't agree with, or by something that is dangerous or false?
Yeah, I'm trying to think about, because we're not saying necessarily like, ladies, stop learning.
Right.
But I do think it's okay for husbands, and there's been certain times well, I mean, we've talked about this in other places, so it's not a secret to people where, at least I hope, I don't think it is. I would have probably baptized our babies before you did, but I had to understand, like, Brian has all these other pastoral things he's learning about, so I need to table my education in this realm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, in a way, when it comes to things that have household implication like that,
yeah,
my conscience is going to be the ruling conscience in the home.
Yeah. So even though, I mean, that it wasn't like a, I wasn't like listening to heresy or something, or like getting into a cult or anything like that. I understand that's a different category, but I also was, I feel like, discerning enough to be able to say, okay, Lexi, now is not the time for this. Pick it up at a later date.
Yeah. And we were talking about it all the time.
Yeah.
And, I think of examples like, you know,
I wasn't going to be pushy.
Right. There are examples where a wife might, all of a sudden, she's gone down a rabbit hole and she's like, announces to her husband, well, I'm Roman Catholic, or that would I'm be Eastern a, Orthodox, a deal. Or, you know, I've been convinced of like this really niche Lutheranism, or, and you know, or even just something maybe, you know, that's pretty radical. Maybe it's something like, yeah, like you mentioned, we were a particular Baptist household and the wife all of a sudden starts reading, listening to audiobooks, and she's pretty wildly convinced of paedobaptism and Presbyterian covenant theology. And then it's kind of like this issue in the home where it's not that she is never going to have different convictions about, you know, about anything from her husband. She's a human being. So is he.
Mm-hmm.
It's that there's a wisdom in how to approach these issues and working together.
Yeah.
So that one is not getting, so especially that the wife is not getting a couple miles ahead of her husband, and then all of a sudden she's in this conundrum where she's trying to drag him somewhere.
Yeah.
Or tempted to.
Yeah. And I think even in other like practical things, like, I don't know, family decisions, medical decisions, less theology related, that you could still very easily fall prey to being deceived and, you know, so many false truths there. Even those times when I'm taking up the bulk of, you know, learning and educating myself to make a better informed decision for the family, somebody else in the family, I still know I have to run everything by you.
Yes.
And I think in some ways, knowing that you're the, where the buck stops sort of a thing.
Yeah.
And knowing that you're going to say, no, this is true, this is false, you know, discern that for me. It actually makes me, I feel like at least, be a better researcher. Because I better know my stuff across the board. I better know all of the alternatives. I better know much more widely than if I was just looking it up for myself, because I have to defend it before you and then say why I think this is a good one, not a good. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. There's an incentive that when you're doing this right, when a husband is performing his role correctly here in working and keeping the garden of truth in the home, he is aware of the state of his flocks, as Proverbs says, a good man is. So he knows where his children and his wife are at intellectually in all sorts of things, not just theological things, but medical. Like, he's also aware of his wife's nature. So he will know these are the ditches that she may be prone to fall into if someone is not there to challenge, or she, like, I genuinely do believe that when Paul in Timothy is talking about the role of teaching in the church in his day and ongoingly in the history of the church up to today, he reaches back to the garden and he says, well, she was deceived, he was not. And lots of people want to say, well, that was just a one-off thing. It's not that women in general are more easily deceived. It's that, well, Eve just happened to be deceived. But that's not really, that doesn't make much sense of Paul's argument there, because he seems to be making a paradigmatic argument, like a paradigm-setting argument for all of the church, that men are to have teaching authority, which is working and keeping the garden of doctrine in the church. What relevance would it have that Eve just happened to be deceived if Paul wasn't saying that in general, this is a tendency that without male headship, the woman will be more easily deceived?
Yeah.
So when Adam's headship went astray in the garden, he was failing to work and keep the garden of truth in his wife's, in with respect to his charge over his wife.
Yeah.
And so she was deceived. He went into it open-eyed. He wasn't deceived. Had he guarded and defended truth, he would have protected his wife from being deceived. So I think it is important. And what you'll see is that in homes without strong male headship, you will tend to see female deception, women falling into various deceptions. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why the term wives' tales is a phrase and not husbands' tales. And it's because this is a real tendency. It's mm-hmm. not that men can't be deceived. Men are deceived all the time. Mm-hmm. It's just there's a particular ordering of the hierarchy of creation where God actually made it such that when the husband and the wife, the man and the woman are working together adequately within their roles, it's mutually protecting for all parties.
Yeah. Yeah. We're more easily, we are more easily deceived, but we're also more easily manipulated with emotions. So right. emotional arguments, we don't want to see people fighting. We're going to try and manipulate others to our side with our emotions. It's very, and that's the opposite side of that is God did make us more emotional because our vocation orbits around people. So if we were yes. just completely emotionless, we wouldn't be very good mothers and caretakers and yeah. wives and daughters. Yeah. And so
there's a reason yeah. why Michael Foster pointed this out. I think actually today, as we record on Twitter, he pointed out that the nature of things can work for or against
yes.
people, the good of the people, depending on the situation. So a woman's general tendency towards peacemaking and nurture is very good in the home with children and with loving her husband and all these things, Titus 2 type of things.
Yeah.
However, when it comes to something like church discipline within the church, it's a very bad instinct. Because all of a sudden, if she's in charge of church discipline, ain't nobody going to get disciplined. Or it's going to be yeah. way too, quote unquote, patient. And what will happen is that sin will get into the church and spread.
Yeah.
Because no one's willing to do the really hard thing of being the man and standing up and saying, no, you are under discipline. You may not continue in this sin. You will be removed from the body if you continue in these sins. It's a very difficult work to do that. It's very emotionally difficult. And so, and men are generally speaking, creationally more equipped
yeah.
for that type of line in the sand, working and keeping of truth. Let me ask you this. We're talking about a husband being a guardian of truth in the home. What are some ways that a wife might encourage and support her husband in being a guardian of truth in the household? She might encourage or discourage him.
I think definitely don't undermine him if he's making a point to make a specific decision about something. Like if he's, I'm thinking culturally, the culture in the home.
Yeah.
If he's drawing a line somewhere where you agree with, where you don't agree with, either because it's too strict or too lax, even if it really genuinely is too lax, you still need to be respectful of it. Even if you say, okay, honey, I think I'm concerned that you're being a little too lax here. Can you explain to me your reasoning behind it at least?
Yeah, privately.
Yeah. So then he can understand. So then she can maybe make a better informed decision as to, she's not just thinking he's an idiot. He probably actually has an informed decision. And if he right. doesn't, then he knows he better get one because his wife is going to ask questions.
She's respectfully asking a question.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, when you think about, it's like the old joke that the wife is always telling the husband, I wish you would help me out more around the house. And then it's like the husband trying to help the wife out around the house. He's loading the dishwasher. And she's like, have you ever loaded a dishwasher in your life? That is not the right way to do it. And then he goes, okay.
Like, yeah.
You know, it's like the, on The Office when Ryan, the temp, when he's like, I want to be led. I want you to lead me, but I don't want you to like lead me too much. You know, like make me want it, you know, convince me. And some of the times wives can be like that.
Yeah.
But the husband's trying to guard and defend truth. And sometimes that does mean, yes, we're going to do this. No, we're not going to do that. Yes, we're going to allow this in the home. No, we're not going to allow this in the home. Yes to this political thing, to this theological thing. No to this political theological thing. Mm-hmm. And she needs to have an instinct of respect and obedience to him in that role in the home, lest she undermine and have her sensibilities rule the home.
Yeah. And that also means she needs to be courageous because with some of these things, like fear of man can really creep mm-hmm. in either with family members that you're worried about what people think about you or friends or, you know, depending on what your husband's job is, you know, maybe even prominent Christians, you're worried what they might think. And this is where I think about the advice to women in 1 Peter 3, I think, about not to fear anything that is fearful. Because when your husband starts drawing lines in any sort of a way, it's going to attract attention from people that would want you to be in the opposite place.
Right.
So you have to be able to cultivate a thick skin.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's exactly why Sarah was told not to fear, because sometimes it can be scary to submit to your husband when you think that he's not right or not exactly right.
Or even if you think he's right and it's just scary.
It's just scary. Yeah, that's right. That's right. So a wife can be a great help to her husband in being a defender of truth and a guardian and a cultivator of truth in their home. She can also be a great enemy of him doing that if she undermines him and sets herself up as the sole arbiter of truth in the home. I'm uncorrectable. I'm going to become offended anytime my husband questions any of my opinions. I'm going to become wildly offended if he ever says, what podcast are you listening to? Or like, what are you thinking there? And we've said this before, even if that's like your husband says, don't listen to Bright Hearth podcast. Well, then don't listen to this podcast, because he is charged with keeping your home. I'm not. Lexi's not.
Yeah.
He is.
I'm too busy to play Pope.
Absolutely. Way too busy to play Pope. Okay, let's talk about goodness. This is related to truth in many. These things all nest together. But when we're talking about goodness, we're talking about moral virtue. We're talking about the cultivation of character in the people in the home. We're talking about loving what is good, hating what is evil, righteousness, holiness, an actual lived out, fruitful love of the good. That's what we say when we say that a household is to cultivate and radiate and defend goodness. So a husband has a particular role that is important in the home. One way that I would think about it in terms of working, so working the garden rather than defending first, is that he's in working goodness in the home. The husband is aiming to set the model for what moral virtue in the home is supposed to look like. For what are we aiming for in this home? Ultimately, we all know that Christ is the model of goodness, okay? So a husband ought to be saying, let's be like Christ in our virtue in the home. However, sometimes we have an instinct to want to collapse everything to its ultimate immediately and not understand how mediate authorities down the chain work. So it's good for Paul to say, imitate Christ, but it's also good for Paul to say, imitate me as I imitate Christ. It is good for a husband to tell his wife, love the Lord. It's also good for a husband to tell his wife, love the children, right? And she can't just say, well, everything's to the glory of God. The children don't matter. She glorifies God by loving the children. So there's steps between where a husband is actually going to take that perfect model in heaven of Christ, and he ought to be, at least as a worker of goodness in the home, he ought to be helping translate that into his home in setting the model for what does goodness look like for my son Johnny in sixth grade, in his setting and vocation and time of life, with his personality and struggles and gifts and all of that. What does it look like for my wife, my particular wife, Lexi? I'm using a fake kid with one example and now the real wife with a different one. It's kind of weird. What does it look like for me to cultivate goodness, to see my wife and say, well, I want my wife to radiate goodness and moral character in this stage of life where we have these children and these are our duties and these are our challenges. These are our obstacles. What can I do now to cultivate? So I'm thinking of the husband that part of his role is to be defining the model or leading his family to the correct model for what moral virtue and goodness actually looks like in the home.
So you're saying he has permission to be more practical about it?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm curious because I feel like dads are really used to doing this for their kids.
Yeah.
But I think the culture isn't so good about doing it as a wife. Do you think you could get a little more specific because I've never even heard of you talking about it that way before.
Yeah, no, that's a good question because it's kind of pie in the sky the way I just described it. So, and you're right. I do think that we're very used to talking about fathers saying, you know, take your sons out, tell him you love them, You're proud of them, yeah. Help them to become godly men.
Like if a husband sees his wife really struggling in a certain area, yeah. I don't know that the average man would know how to even think through that
to
help her.
The first thing I would say practically is that he must have the right model in mind. So he has to be familiar with what goodness actually means and looks like. He needs to know the difference between courage and cowardice. He needs to know the difference between truth and lies, between self-control and the man ruled by his passions.
Okay.
Okay, so he has to have the right model, which is just only can be formed truly. Mm-hmm. Virtue means it's actually from the word vir for man, vir for man. It's like the ideal man. So he has to know Christ, and he has to have Christ cultivating the fruit of the Spirit in himself, knowledge of the scriptures. He has to know the authentic thing. But then the second order from that, the second rung down, is that he has to know the state of his flock. He has to, like, pay attention to his wife. Could a husband sit down and say, these are the general temptations of my wife. These are her general strengths morally. Here's a situation that would tempt her to sin. And here's a situation that would set her up so that her moral virtues would shine. He should know that about his wife. And then he has to act. So he has to know the model. He has to see his wife accurately to see the difference, the gap between his wife and the model, mm-hmm. just like he is with himself when he's mm-hmm. looking in the mirror of the word. The word is showing you the difference between the standard and you. And then he has to act. And this is where most husbands have some idea of the good. They have some knowledge of their wife and they see the gap and they fail to act because either they don't know how, they're scared to, they've tried in the past and their wife does not submit to it and gets worse, you know, like a lot of the time.
I have determined to be worse.
After careful consideration, I have decided to become worse. But think about it. Absolutely. Like, let's say that, what are some sins common to women? Okay. Nagging her husband. And then he says, honey, I've noticed that you've been really naggy the last 6 months since the little one was born. And I know you're tired and you're not getting as much sleep and things are difficult and challenging.
But it's time to do away with this.
You need to put that sin to death because it's really wreaking havoc in the home. And then if she responds by saying, first of all, how dare you? Second of all, who do you think that you are? Third of all, here's a list of all of your sins, which are reasons why I don't have to repent of any of mine. Okay, so I think that process can help him be a defender of goodness in the home, or she can radically undermine him. But he must encourage with gentleness, Galatians 6:1, help his wife. Mm-hmm. So it might look just practically, like let's say there's a scenario where a husband is noticing that the last, you know, 3 out of the last 4 days he came home from work, the house was absolute chaos. None of the kids were being disciplined and his wife was just frustrated and yelling at everybody. And that was how she was managing the difficulty of the children. Okay. He's noticing something that is a lack of goodness in the home. It's a lack of virtue, starting with a lack of virtue in his wife. I know he's responsible ultimately, right? But she's clearly not managing her duties well.
Yeah.
And she's reacting in the flesh to try and control the chaos with her flesh. And it's just going to get more flesh out of the kids.
Yeah.
Okay, so what does he do? One of the things he needs to do is to talk to his wife and correct her and tell her what he's seeing, asking how he can help, not just asking for bricks without straw. How can I help you? Do you see this as well? And what's our game plan to actually walk in the Spirit and crucify the deeds of the flesh, starting with me and you? Right. Mm-hmm. So he can be a defender of goodness in his home by doing that, I think.
Yeah. I think too, similar to like disciplining a toddler, the sooner you do it, it's going to be easier than letting things get out of hand.
Yes.
So I actually think it's okay, even in seasons of sleeplessness, for a husband to expect cheerfulness from a wife.
Yes.
And if absolutely. You see it after a day or two of like what's been going on the last few days, you remain cheerful in the correction and asking about it, but also do not wait for mom to stomp out of the house and say she's never coming home until you get her a maid. Like that is not, that's way too far gone.
Yeah.
So I think it's okay for husbands to insist on swift correction, even when a wife is out of line.
And one of the things that can be an enemy of this is the therapeutic culture of our world that will do everything, especially for women, to give them excuses and diagnoses to justify and explain away their sin.
Yeah.
Instead of repentance, faith, and reconciliation to God and men.
Yeah.
So a lot of a time, a wife, we've used the example of a postpartum situation. Mm-hmm. There are real things in postpartum that are difficult, physically difficult. Our culture demands her to return to full function within like a week.
Including church.
When traditionally she would have been abed and protected and helped. Mm-hmm. And the fourth trimester kind of understanding that we've lost. So there are some real things there. There's things like postpartum depression that are absolutely real. But there is also such thing as where instead of recognizing that this difficult situation of life, having a child, maybe it's a difficult labor, whatever, maybe you don't have as much help as would be ideal from family and things like that. Maybe husband has to go back to work or you guys can't pay your bills quicker than you'd like.
Yeah.
And so there's the ideal. It's like 90 days of beauty and tranquility and the husband's there and family's there and it's all great. And then you're like, that's not our situation. How easy is it for a wife then to use all of those real things as a cloak for, I'm just going to let my flesh run wild now.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I don't have to fight pity parties at all. I don't have to make war with my sin at all. I can be an absolute hag to everybody around me because my life is hard. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, we culturally justify that for women, where if a man who's working out in the oil rig and he's working 17-hour days, you know, 7 days a week in a season of life, and he comes home and he snaps at his wife.
You still feel bad for the wife.
Nobody justifying his sin.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Either of them should be justified is my point. Not that his should.
No, I know. But I just mean, typically people just feel bad for the wife, though.
Yeah, they would still feel bad for the wife. The husband with the wife who's postpartum and having a really hard time, no one feels bad for him.
No.
They're usually like, oh, what is your problem? You did this. You got her pregnant. And he's like, well, you know, it was mutual. Like we were both at the time interested in one another. Not that she, you know, she seems to not be able to remember or imagine being interested in me now, but you know, so when we're talking about keeping, defending the home from that, which is defiling, I think it's also important just to mention something we've talked about before, which is that the husband needs to be one of the doorways into the home, the main doorway or moat for the content that is coming into the home in terms of books, media.
That's what I was thinking earlier with culture.
Yeah.
Yeah. The culture of the home.
Yeah. He's the one who's going to be like, hey, this is what kind of movie we're okay with. Mm-hmm. And this is the kind that we're not okay with. And he's not necessarily going to enforce that his lines on every single family around him, but he is responsible for his family to say, no, like for us, one of my greatest fears is my children, especially my sons, having access to video games anytime soon. Because I know that riding your bike and building a Ford is much more difficult.
Yeah.
The dopamine is harder to come by than building a Minecraft fort and riding a Minecraft bicycle. I don't know if you can do such a thing, but
Sims maybe?
Right.
Is Sims still a thing?
The simulators, yeah. So I know how easy it would be for my sons to get absolutely sucked into, because they're genuinely fun video games, especially for boys. They're very fun and enjoyable. If you enjoy video games responsibly, I'm not nagging you right now. I'm not saying they're absolutely not for acceptable in any circumstances. I played occasional GoldenEye Temple of Doom. But I am, personally, it's a hard line where the closest thing to a video game I've allowed in our home is my son was allowed to purchase a handheld black and white Pac-Man game that he could play like on the airplane when he went with me on a trip. And
even that has restrictions.
And it's not quite like, that is like a Coca-Cola, but an Xbox, whatever they're on with Halo is like crack cocaine. So, I mean, he likes the little video game, but the addictive quality of it is like a Coca-Cola compared to the crack cocaine or heroin of a full immersive war game where he can, you know, be in the battle and be shooting the bad guy. Man, those are addictive. And I think I don't want my sons anywhere near them until their character is more fully formed and their habits.
Yeah. It was reading, like that, that Norwegian Oscar winning composer that has written all these songs to all their favorite movies. And I showed them recently, he said when he got up there, he was like, I am thanking for my mom and dad for not letting me play video games. And I showed the boys, I was like, look, you love his music. Look what he said.
Yeah.
He said, thanks mom and dad for making me do piano practice.
Cause they be honest, when you were 10 years old as a boy, would you rather do your 45 minutes a day of piano practice or play Halo?
I don't think I still probably the last 5 years specifically, are there things that I'm like, wow, I'm so glad my mom and dad made me do that. So that's the hard part, is like the gratification really isn't going to come until maybe a few decades into their adult life. It's hard for both because there's immediate gratification for both parents and children.
Yeah. Because the parents get a break.
Yeah.
The kids will just sit there quietly and play a video game. If they all have a controller, they'll do it for 6 hours straight. What other activity do you not have to supervise your kids for 6 hours?
Yeah, exactly.
None. TV, movies, maybe that's about it. I think it was Hans Zimmer that said that, right? Interstellar soundtrack, and he's one of the greatest film composers who is alive today.
He's pretty young. I think he's maybe our age or younger even.
Interstellar, that is one of the greatest soundtracks, I think, in film. It's so good and it's so creative, and it clearly, he knows his craft, and he wouldn't have done it if he'd been glued to the video game.
Yeah.
Here at Bright Hearth, we're all about helping you not turn into a girl if you're a boy, or into a boy if you're a girl. You know what might be doing that to you? The soap in your shower. And so we are pleased to introduce you to IndigoSundriesSoap.com, link in the description, of course, who can provide you with soaps and more without any of the nasty stuff. And because they love you, they're giving you a discount code, guys. So use code, all caps, BRIGHTHEARTH, for 10% off your whole order. Support this great Christian company and support BrightHeart Podcast at the same time. Check them out at IndigoSundriesSoap.com. And of course, that link is in the description. So there's things like that where a husband, in terms of goodness, you have to stop and think as a husband before you say your yes to something. Because when you say your yes to something, it's much harder to take it back out than it is if you defended the home early from it. It's kind of like your point that the husband needs to help the wife repent of her sin quickly. It's much harder if you've let the thing get roots than if you just guard it from the beginning. And I'm not saying be the fun-sucking father that he says no to every fun thing.
Oh, no, there's plenty of stuff.
But he needs to say yes to the right things.
Yeah.
And he really, the no is much more important in many ways than the yes. So that when the yes comes, it's like, I'm telling you yes to, we're going to go backpacking. We're going to get fit. We're going to take our stuff out. We're going to fish. We're going to go to the High Uintas. It's going to be hard. It's going to be fun. You're going to have memories for life, you know, around some of these things.
Yeah. I think a good example in our life is, you know, after dinner times and in the summer, you are pretty normally going to say yes to taking the boys on long bike rides.
Yeah.
Whereas the reason that had to be a yes was because like TV and video games is a normative no for us.
That's exactly right. Okay. Lastly, let's talk about the husband as working and keeping beauty in the home. And obviously I think we could say everything we did in the first episode about the husband's attitude, that he ought to be cheerful. Mm-hmm. Like beauty, you could think about it in a masculine way in terms of stateliness, respectability, the beauty of, there's a masculine beauty that is like the beauty of a good king in his realm. Mm-hmm. Gondor is a beautiful city, partly because of the cultivation, the working and keeping of the king there, Aragorn, or the kings of the city. So in a home, a husband is, starting with his attitude, going to cultivate and defend beauty in that way. I think we could say everything from the last episode. But what else could we say practically about the way a husband can cultivate traditions and culture of beauty, lived beauty in terms, because I'm thinking of beauty, for example, as reading a good book aloud as a part of beauty in a home just as much as like hanging a painting on the wall. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, I think this is probably the biggest area for husbands to be tempted towards pragmatism.
Yeah.
Absolutely. In all areas. Yeah. Like, you might be a husband who's all about, yeah, let's go read the books. That's an okay source of beauty, but don't you dare touch the savings to get any new furniture.
Right. Yeah.
So, or guys on the complete opposite spectrum where they're like, sure, babe, whatever you want to do in the house, just don't bother me to ever read you a book at night.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Both sides of the coin.
So, that's what I would say is, like, you cannot be a pragmatist with your view of beauty in the home. It's not going to work because it's not practical.
I think about the implications of this for everything from the wife and children's dress to the environment of the home, to the books that they're reading, on the music they're listening to, the vacations they're going on, mm-hmm. is that he's overseeing, again, he has to have a vision of beauty, which is why I think men should be reading books like Scruton's books, and they should be reading and cultivating an ideal of beauty.
Scruton.
Well, see, I've said it that way, and then all of the nerds who love him.
I've only ever heard it called Scruton.
Here's how we'll split
Scruton.
The difference. You say Scruton, I'll say Scruton, and then they can.
Can we say it the Utah way? How would the Utahns say it?
They would have added six syllables, and it would have been Scrutley.
Scruton. No T's. Utahns don't say T's.
His name would be Scruton. Carrogerly, and it would be like C-A. R-O-G.
Sorry, I really just derailed us.
Okay. He has to have a vision of beauty.
So men should be reading books like Roger Scruton's books.
Yeah, they should be cultivating an ideal of beauty in terms of, this is going to sound, some feminists would twist this and make me sound controlling, but an ideal of beauty for his wife, an ideal of beauty for his children, ideal of beauty for the environment of the home, ideal of beauty for the vacations they go on, media in the home, the music, all these things.
What do you mean an idea
things.
Of beauty for his wife?
I mean that...
Do unpack this.
A husband should desire and expect his wife to be beautiful and to be beautifully adorned. That doesn't mean that he has like a vision of beauty where she's another woman. You know, mm-hmm. It's like, yeah. Oh, she needs to be taller and have thicker lips and all this stuff. No. That'd be pornographic and evil. I'm talking about he loves his wife. And so he wants to cultivate in her beauty. He wants to cultivate mm-hmm. her beauty, her inner and outer beauty to be in harmony with one another. Like, for example, if his wife is dressing frumpily and just like giving up, he should have something to say about that in a tender and loving and providing way, mm-hmm. saying, no, I don't want to come home and see that you are still in pajamas. Mm-hmm. I want to come home and see that you are adorned as a beautiful woman, that you're mm-hmm. wearing... In my opinion, it's dressing like a woman, not wearing the garments of a man, not looking masculine. So it's like, I want my wife in a dress. And so my wife is in a dress because I've asked her to be. Not that you don't like dresses or you were, you know, hated them or something like that. But we've talked about this mm-hmm. over the years. And some of it developed for me where I was like, day one didn't have this elaborate, you know, Handmaid's Tale kind of thing. But just, I like you in a dress, so I praise you, your beauty in when I look and I say, wow, my wife is beautiful today in this, I tell you. Because I want you to know what I like. When your hair is a certain way, when your attitude is a certain way, when you're, you know, this sounds weird and creepy the way I'm explaining it, I think. But does that make sense? Are you following me?
No, it does make sense. It's always weird to me that women complain about this because it almost always equates to some sort of shopping spree for them. So it's so weird to me that women even complain about this.
This has cost me money. This has not saved me money. I'm like, no, babe, here's some money. Please, I want you to go buy some more dresses because I love seeing you in a dress. I think you look feminine and beautiful. Please don't cut your hair in a short pixie cut.
No bangs.
And I'm not in that right now trying to impose all of my preferences on all of your homes. Don't hear me saying that. I'm giving you an example of, I do think there's universals, but I am giving an example here of, I have preferences mm-hmm. for some of this stuff mm-hmm. that are not universals, mm-hmm. but that are important to me as a cultivator of beauty in the home. My mm-hmm. children, I want them to be, like, there's a reason we have uniforms at our school, and mm-hmm. I'm on the board. I'm one of the people who decided that. You know, in the home, it means that I have to give Lexi money to buy stuff that I wouldn't buy. Mm-hmm. That's further afield from my, you know, where I have great expertise or something like that. So I trust Lexi more that when we're furnishing a house or when we're, you know, putting stuff on the wall, I'm going to say,
yeah,
you do it.
Yeah. And there's been times when either like you say, I'll tackle that project.
Yeah.
Or there's also been times where you say, I don't have the time for that, but you're free to hire somebody.
Yes.
So I think that's something for a husband to be aware of is like the Lord gave your wife a desire to make a home for a reason. Everybody will benefit from that. She needs to be reasonable with her expectations and desires, but don't be the husband that's like, no, I won't do that for you. I won't learn, but you also can't have somebody help you do that either. Don't be that guy, because that's like morale sucking.
Yeah. And there is such thing as being broke and still working hard and having like early in your marriage life, lots of times or lots of kids where you say,
that's why I said she has to have reasonable expectations. Totally.
I can't afford to buy a $12,000 dining set made of European mahogany and that is handcrafted by a local artisan. I genuinely, guys, could not do that. I couldn't say, babe, go for it. Buy the $12,000 dining set. Some other family, God bless them, might be able to do that. And the husband might be able to bless his wife that way. And I wouldn't also curmudgeon at them and say, well, you could have given that to the poor. Whatever. Love your wife. Get the $12,000 dining set if you're able and it's responsible for you fiscally, whatever. But I am saying that it probably wouldn't be good for me if during our whole marriage I said, babe, we can't have a dining room table that's nice. We only are going to use a flimsy folding card table forever because we're broke or because I don't want to spend money on that. It's a waste. It's tempting for husbands sometimes to see beauty as a waste.
Again, pragmatism.
Pragmatism. But they need to resist this because human beings are aesthetic creatures.
Yes.
Right? We're aesthetic creatures. The environment matters. There's a reason that people, I'm telling you, I can't cite studies off the top of my head, but when you put human beings, like say children in a classroom, in a wood paneled, beautiful classroom and do their daily education there, they will have better outcomes in their schooling even than if you put them in a concrete room with dim or harsh fluorescent lighting that is uncomfortable and unpleasant aesthetically to be in.
If you read old books too, I really am starting to come to this conviction more and more. I think Mother Carey's Chickens might be an example of one, but I know I've read even Elizabeth Gouge's books. It's if somebody was flipping a house in old books, they did not move in until it was done. It was beautified and it was done. Mother Carey's Chickens talk about doing it on a budget. She became a widow and they had to move to a smaller house, but they flipped the house to make it beautiful. That is so countercultural to what we do today, which is constantly tweaking and changing and never actually living in any sort of permanent beauty. Does that make sense? I don't know why. I've been thinking about it a lot. I don't know what's happened there culturally, but it's not normative anymore for us to actually want everything to be good and in its place. Maybe it's just we're too casual and so everything's messy constantly, but and we don't discipline our kids to know how to take care of things anymore. It's just so abnormal for us to be so displaced and uprooted is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. I think also things like mass production culture. I think of things like the loss of intergenerational households. So a household would have been the work of multiple generations instead of just, you're not establishing five new homes in your lifetime, typically in a lot of periods of history and places. I think that the size of houses also plays into it. Houses are much larger today on average than they were even 50 years ago and especially 100 years ago. So imagine affording to take a 1,400 square foot cottage where all of your children live and you have three bedrooms total in the whole house and you have two generations living there. It's much cheaper to beautifully adorn 1,300 square feet than 4,300 square feet.
That's totally true. Space is a huge part of it. Yeah.
Space is a part of it. So there's lots of reasons I think why that's the case and that you can't live in a world that doesn't exist, but you can work to recover things that have been lost.
Yeah.
In terms of, so you might be able to start small and work your way up and maybe say like, okay, our bedroom's going to be beautiful.
Did you see the thing I posted yesterday on Twitter about the gardens?
I feel like I did.
I really liked that, where they were, it was an example of like, how we don't even have garden meeting spaces anymore for intergenerational relationships to exist. And they just gave an example of like a really young girl being encouraged by an older woman, and the, just the fact that there was a bench there in the garden and she gained, you know, X amount of wisdom through that conversation that we don't even allow. It's impractical to have beautiful gardens now with benches that,
you know,
it was just a really good, like, wow, we've lost something, but also at the same time, there's so much good, beautiful rebuilding to do that it actually makes me excited to think about, you know, doing that and planning that. And
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there's challenges here with all these things, but I'm thinking as a husband, my goal is to work and keep the garden, the household, such that it produces and defends truth, goodness, and beauty. And so I think it's important, again, to sort of summarize that a husband would just work on getting in his mind on all these things, an image and a model of what are we actually trying to attain as a household in all these different areas of life, and constantly working to build out the mental model that would accurately live in the world God made and the scriptures that he gave. So we would say, this is truly what a what education ought to be for my children. And then work to close the gap between that model and life, being gracious and patient and depending on the Lord, and not, you know, in the might of chariots or horses, but in the might of the Lord. And then also doing this in a way that's gracious to those under his care and charge, where he cares about the people first, and he's aiming to defend and protect the people and cultivate the people as the greatest aspect of his legacy and truth, goodness, and beauty. And as he does this, and he's going to have to repent of sin and work hard, and there's all sorts of things that he'll have to do, I believe the Lord delights to bless men who take up that mantle and aim to do that with all of their might.
Yeah.
So thanks for listening, guys. And just one last shout out. If you like what we do here at Bright Hearth and you want to support the ongoing work that we do in this podcast, then you can join as a patron that helps us keep doing what we're doing. And we have a few ways of saying thanks for everybody supporting that with our In the Kitchen show that we do most weeks for supporters there on Patreon. Our mid-level tier of support, we will send you a sweet Feed the Patriarchy mug. And guess what, guys? Pretty soon here, we're going to be updating in the next year across New Christendom Press. We're going to be updating a lot of our design and the merch type of things for a lot of our different shows and things. So keep an eye out for that. And we hope to have some really fun ones for you guys in the next year that you can check out. And sign up for the conference if you haven't already. We'd love to have you there in June here in Ogden. We've got plenty of seats. We've got a huge venue at a historic school building on the east bench of the mountains, right just walking distance from our church. And it's going to be just a great time. I'm going to be doing a concert there. There's a singles mixer. There'll be lots of great talks from Dr. Joe Rigney, Dr. Stephen Wolf. I'll be speaking. There'll be a lot of just great opportunities to fellowship and meet like-minded folks as well, make new friendships. And we would love to have you guys there. Stay through Sunday. We'll be doing our Sunday service at the venue so that we have enough room for everybody. So come join us in Ogden. Stay for a couple days. Stretch your legs. And we would be delighted to have you guys. But thanks for listening to this episode of Bright Hearth. And until next time, festin alente, make haste slowly.